I'm not pulling out of my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another Drive to Work, coronavirus edition. Okay, so I've been lining up fun interviews, and I have another blast from the past. So I want to introduce Devin Lowe.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, Devin. So before we get to all your time at Wizards, I want to ask the question I've been asking all my people on the interviews is, how did you start playing Magic?
I used to go to gaming conventions with my dad, who was playing a lot of miniature war games, and I won some random event at some convention that gave me like a $10 gift certificate to spend at some vendor there. So I went there, whatever, under $10, not a board game, not a miniatures game, that was too expensive. Hey, they got a boost practice called Magic. I could buy two or three of those. So the price was right, and there it was. So I didn't have a rule book. I just had some packs that had like Grizzly Bears and Guy's Legion Forest and Mox Emerald, and that was enough to get me hooked.
So how about, this was Alpha? How far back was this?
93, so Alpha, yeah.
Yeah, Alpha, okay.
With the weird corners and everything.
Okay, so how old were you when you started playing?
I want to say 14.
Okay, so did you continue playing? Like, how'd you get into the game?
Yeah, I had a very small amount of cards for a very, very long time. Some of my friends that I was playing with had like bought boxes, and that was like totally foreign to me. I bought like a few packs here and there like per year. And so I had a small collection of Magic cards, enough for like three decks or something. It was like a big deal that I could make a deck of all black cards. That's the color I happened to have the most of. I couldn't make a deck of all of any other single color. But I dutifully took these with me and taught kids to play at summer camps, at school, and I would like, you know, play this Giant Spider deck against this Hypnotic Spectre deck. That's a matchup where I like the spider. And just kind of see, you know, just play it out. And looking back in those days, I can sort of still imagine those alpha artworks in my head. And it seems like a different game entirely than one that I ended up working on, right? It has like a mystical aura of like remembering there's holy armor and that weird guy with the armored horns and a big flail. And, you know, you cast unholy strength on your vampire bats and how cool that was.
So did you play continuously from when you started, or did you take a break?
I never took any breaks. Not really. It really kicked into high gear after I got to Harvard, and some of the guys there were playing a ton of tournaments and trying to get the Pro Tour, and were very excited about that and trying to figure out how to win the game, how to get inside the physics of it. And so I started hanging out with those guys, and Your Move Games was a big influence on that group. Obviously, it has a bunch of Pro Tour champions coming out of there. And we started playing PTQs, and I won a few of them, and I went through three Pro Tours in 2000, and then that eventually was instrumental in me getting to Wizards.
So, okay, how did you get to Wizards? How'd that happen?
So my mom let me know that she knew I loved the game, and she told me that my cousin was the nanny of Richard Garfield. It's pretty weird. She was like, you should go and meet him sometime, like, you know, see if you can go say hi. And I was like, oh, Mom, like, that'd be so embarrassing. I can't just, like, go say hi to him. Like, what would I say? And I was like, too cool and too embarrassed to do it. She's like, no. You should do this. Like, okay, fine. So I went to meet Richard. He's amazing. He's very smart. He had already changed my life for the better by the time I met him. And that was before he changed my life 10 more times the better by, you know, being the grandfather of something that shaped my whole career. But he was very nice and welcoming. And he offered to like play a board game with me sometime with his friends. So I did that a couple of times. And then eventually, I sort of harbored a secret thought of applying to Wizards someday, but I kept putting it off, right? It's easy to give yourself reasons not to take the leap and put yourself out there to sort of get judged and probably rejected. But I was reading a latest developments column that was written by Randy Bueller, a column that I would eventually someday write. And he was showing the Vapor Ops test of what they showed prospective Wizards applicants to sort of get a sense of how good they were at analyzing the game. And he published this in his column and encouraged people to sort of like send in their answers. And I thought, oh, geez, this is going to prompt 10 million people to actually apply because they'll be interested in the process. They'll think they're pretty good answers and they'll want to send them in and try to get in the door. So I thought, I missed my chance. Woe is me. I'm a terrible person for not applying before now because now the huge wave is going to come in. But the least I can do is to try to pitch myself now that this moment has arrived, and at least kind of like try to like get in at the front of this wave of applicants that's inevitably gonna show up. And so I took the test, tried to do a good job, and sort of put together a packet of why I thought I could add value to the company making Magic sets. And I sent it to Garfield, and he gave it to a buddy of his at Wizards, who was Bill Rose. And then a few months later, a slot opened up, and he gave me a call. And we had an interview, and he said, okay, come up for 6 months. And then 6 months eventually turned to full time in 5 years, and I eventually became the head developer of Magic at a time when Rosewater was obviously the head designer of Magic, and so it was great to collaborate. And worked a bunch of Magic sets, worked a bunch of non-Magic sets, sort of warming up to Magic. I worked a bunch of other Wizards games that were sort of the more B-list stuff. But I had a great time there. It was a big part of my life. And after that, I went on to work on other hobby games and other card games. And so it was instrumental. It was a big deal.
Okay, let's go back a little bit. Let's spend a little more time walking through the time at Wizards. Okay, so you get hired at Wizards. Okay, so what is the first thing? What's the first Magic thing you worked on?
The very first thing they had to work on is like Neopets and Duelmasters, all these sort of non-Magic games. But I had very good work on Magic, as many people are. And so they had a slot on the Fifth Dawn development team. They were really close to the end. But I hopped on there with Brian Schneider, I think, leading it. And, got a couple of cards in the file through hole filling. And it's the kind of thing where the people that have been there for 5 years, the hole filling comes up like, oh, yeah, it's one more thing I have to do. My list of 12 things I have to do. But for a new person there, hole filling is like the most exciting thing in the universe because you might make a Magic card. And so I would put a lot of energy in trying to make really good hole fills and try to impress people, get them in the file. And I got some in, and that was like already mind blowing.
Yeah, it's very funny. Even today, we still do hole filling. And you're right. Like the old times, like, not more hole filling. And the new people are like, I get to make Magic cards. And they make a lot of cards. So it's very funny. Okay, so Fifth Dawn. So then we moved into Kamigawa Block. Did you work on anything in Kamigawa Block?
Yeah, I was a tester only for Champions, and still working mostly in other games. But I was a developer on Betrayers, and I was a co-designer on Saviors. And it was a time when we were just starting to realize that Mirrodin was going to have a bunch of like power level problems. And a bunch of Wizards resources that had been historically used on playtesting had been sort of like diverted during that time period to work on like Transformers and Star Wars CCGs kind of stuff. I guess not Transformers, I guess Star Wars. And so that was part of why Mirrodin had some power level mistakes in it, to put it lightly. And I eventually became the first of sort of wave of new developer designers that they hired to sort of come and fix that and make our resource bench stronger so that we could find more of those power level problems and fix them before they got out of hand. And so sort of during the Kamigawa year, I think we ended up hiring myself, Mike Turian, and Matt Place, and Paul Sodesanti. Aaron came over from the website. Eventually, sort of a second wave of folks after that. But a bunch of people came into that time, more than a commitment R&D in the years previous.
Okay, so after Kamigawa Block was Ravnica Block. So did you work on anything in the original Ravnica Block? Did you work on anything?
I was a co-designer on Guild Pact, and the idea of the guilds was something that the game hadn't really had since then, but it was hugely influential because so many sets since then have essentially had guilds of varying kinds, whether it's been Return to Ravnica or whether it's been Shards or whether it's been Cons or something. And you sort of see that idea of, let's take a subculture in this world and give them their own mechanic, you give them their own color identity, and give them an ethos that will help players find the guild they identify with and feel kinship to the game through their expression in the guild.
So here's a question. You were around at the time. What do you remember? When I first pitched the guilds, it was not universally taken as a positive thing. Do you remember your take on the guilds, your first impression?
I mean, I don't think I don't remember being anti it or for it. I know it's the iconic Mark Rosewater story to say, I pitched this cool idea and R&D told me, no, they're a bunch of sticks in the butt. But then I kept persisting and then I won out and then the players loved it. Victory, Mark Rosewater. And it is true that has happened many times, but it is a funny iconic Mark Rosewater story. And this is probably one of those too, but I don't remember being pro or anti.
I think the thing that it wasn't the thing that threw people in R&D was that we had to make a draft for all three sets. And I think the real worry was we couldn't have these colors here, these colors here, these colors here, and make a draft that would possibly work. I think that was the biggest worry. It was also weird to them that this set had a red-blue card, and no other set had the red-blue card. That was weird, but
I remember that Torment and Judgment had come before this, and Torment had more black cards than the regular Magic set, and Judgment had more white and green cards than the Magic set, and those have been, like, pretty popular, at least by our understanding. And so that sort of opened the door a little bit to have color imbalance, right? And say, like, it's not totally insane to have a set with all the colors on balance. It is funny to me how the brand and marketing folks at the time were like, well, what if players don't realize that there are any guilds in the set? And RD's like, guys, this is not a problem. It's one thing they're going to realize is that there are guilds in the set. We're like, no, we think some people might just, like, not even pick up that there are guilds. And so they insisted we add Ravnica City of Guilds to be the set name and not just Ravnica, because they really wanted people to know their guilds there. And by the time set came out, it seemed preposterous that anyone possibly not know there's guilds there. They're all over the art, the names, the flavor text, the abilities, everything.
Yeah, it's funny. So the two people, so I and Brady Dommermuth, who was the head of the creative team at the time, we and I were fighting against that. And then he and I went on vacation on the same week, and that's when they changed it.
That's fine. It's also a classic Wizard thing of if there's some card that only one person on the team likes and they go on vacation, the card's inevitably going to be killed while they're gone. Like, it's very dangerous to go on vacation. Like, all the things you like will be toast.
Okay, so the next set after, the next block after that was Time Spiral Block. So this is the first time you led something, correct?
Yes. I remember...
But what did you lead since you and I know? But
it was Planar Chaos, which I think that Paul Sedasan, who was on the design team for, possibly the lead of, and
The lead was Aaron. I was Bill Rose, but okay, Paul was on it.
Okay, and so I was going to lunch, and Paul's in the car. We're talking about Planar Chaos and how, like, oh, it's going to be all this crazy stuff, and we're all a little worried about it. And I literally said something like I feel bad the person's going to like lead that development team. And then Paul was like, Devin, they're saying that it might be you leading that development team, which I hadn't heard before. And I was like, oh, in that case, it'll be fine. It'll all work out. No problem. But it was scary at the time to think about breaking the color wheel in dramatic ways. And Planar Chaos was going to fool around with having all the colors do different things. The structure was the past, an alternate present, and the future. And so part of the alternate present was, what if you use the same color philosophies but express those through different mechanics? And so red is all about sort of short-term gain and who cares what the consequences of the future. And so what if you gave red some ability to return creatures to their owner's hand on the basis that that was a short-term solution that sort of didn't think about the future because the creatures would just come right back next turn? And so red got some bounce spells, and there were a bunch of other color pie shifts that were not typical, were sort of things you would never do, and we were going to do them all. And then they were also talking about maybe doing purple in that set as a sixth color, which was very terrifying to me, and I'm very glad we didn't do.
We did explore that in the design. We ended up sort of not going that path, but we did really, really explore it. At the one set, we're like, maybe we'll do this. It's a brand new color pie. It's an alternate reality. What if it had six colors? So we did explore it, but we didn't end up doing it. The Planar Chaos to this day is one of the things I'm like, I'm not sure we should have done that. I get people all the time defending things by showing me Planar Chaos cards as proof that the color should do it. And yeah. I'm like, okay, guys, please stop using Planar Chaos as the...
I can also remember arguing with some guy named Mark Rosewater, where he kept saying that the structure block was past, alternate, present, future, which definitely is a nice kind of like, you know, rhyme to it, right? Like it makes sense in your head as a triptych. And I would say things like, look, Mark, there's a bonus sheet in Planar Chaos and has these color-shifted versions of old cards where you're used to seeing a Black Knight from Alpha, and now it's a red version. It's still two-color mana for 2/2 first strike per wipe, but now it's red instead, and it's called Blood Knight. So this is really a alternate version of the past. All these are past cards we're working on. They're not really alternate cards of the present. So in a way, it's past, alternate past, future. And I was like, you know, trying to convince Mark that there's something wrong with the past, present, future modeling. And Mark's trying to convince me and trying to help me get it. And I'm like, not getting it. He's like, getting more frustrated. And eventually he's like, Devin, what's going to sell better? Past, present, future, or past, alternate past, future? And I was like, past, present, future. And he's like, exactly. And I was like, okay, Mark, you win. Past, alternate, present, future. And you were right.
So.
And so that is a version of an iconic Mark Rosewater story, by the way. Because there's you saying something, maybe you get stick in the mud, and then you convince me to be triumphant. So there you go. There's one.
So there's a lot of stories, by the way, where I was wrong. I tell the stories where I was right. So they say that people who write the history have lots of control of what happened. So.
Yep, that's one good reason to do 700 podcasts and 20 articles.
Okay, so the next block was the Lorwyn block. So Lorwyn, Morningtide, Shadowmoor, Eventide. So let's talk about that. So you led, what set did you lead?
I led Lorwyn, and it has a very dear place in my heart. I really have a lot of affection for it. We worked so much on it, and the things we cared about the most were just having all the tribes have a very strong mechanical identity and having them feel a certain way and play a certain way, and that when you played Giants or Tree Folk or Kithkin or Merfolk, you would really feel like you were doing that. And also to sort of fix some of the problems that Onslaught Block had as the tribal focus block in the past that had been popular but had some problems in it, like it had Sparksmith as a common that said 1R11 goblin tap to deal X damage to target creature and X damage to you, where X is the number of goblins you control. And so if you play 2/2 Sparksman, if your opponent's like, okay, here we go, I'll play some kind of 2/2 more for 3, and you're like, well, play a second goblin on turn 3, tap Stormfist, deal 2 to your creature, 2 to me, and for the rest of the game, you have this like common that taps to kill your opponent's creatures, and the game was just over at that point. And Onslaught Block Constructed had like a ton of very powerful rats, like Slice and Dice and Chroma's Vengeance, and that made the sort of Tribal Matters theme kind of problematic, because it's not fun to play a bunch of clerics on the board and then a million powerful rats destroy them all the time. And so the tribe that sort of like was able to overcome that were the goblins, because they were hasty and could get through all the rats and everything else, and that sacrifice specs get around the rats, but the other tribes all kind of got crushed by that.
Yeah, the other big thing... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you, please.
Well, the other big thing I know that I was a big proponent of was getting them out of one color. Like, one of the problems in Onslaught is if you want to play goblins, they were red. That's what they were. Yeah. And it made less diversity of deck building because your only choice was red, so you just play the best red cards.
Right.
And so all of the tribes were in at least two colors, I believe, in Lorwyn. A few of them were more than two.
Right. Lorwyn was also the very first set to introduce Planeswalkers, and that was a very hard project, and a lot of things could have gone wrong. And it kind of blows my mind that the fundamental Planeswalker structure, we basically got it in Lorwyn the first time out. I mean, the first time we published it, not the first time we iterated on it internally. And it has held since then, where they have loyalty, they often have 3 abilities, they often have an ultimate, they often have a plus ability and a sort of a moderate minus ability. I know we've done some variations on it since then, but fundamentally, that structure was good. And of the original 5, Garrick, Liliana, Johnny, Chandra, Jace, all those first 5 got deconstructed. They were all like good and limited. And none of them were like overpowered or insane. And so like we really delivered on a very hard ask by making the Planeswalkers good first time out.
Yeah, I've talked with Aaron about that too, that like it's kind of mind-blowing how correct we were.
Like, yeah, it's mind-blowing how correct we were. Like, yeah. They're all kind of like printable now. Like, they're all pretty close.
Yeah, no, we did spend a bunch of time, as just people who know the history, Future Sight was originally going to do them, and then we didn't think we had them right, so we spent more time, and then we thought we had it, obviously we did, but, okay, so, did you work on anything else in that block?
I was a co-designer and developer on Shadowmoor. Mm-hmm. I remember that one of the issues with Lorwyn also is that it was trying to deliver on a cutesy fair tale world that would set up the horror of the world turning evil when Shadowmoor happened, right? Lorwyn is bubbling brooks, beautiful meadows, pretty happy campers. The terrors that's names like Pie in the Face that were just like, that's as close you get to violence as like a pie in the face. And it was overly cutesy in order to have a horrific reveal when Shadowmoor flipped the world on its head, some sort of eclipse happens, all the good creatures turn evil, all the pleasant things become sinister, and now the world's like nice and creepy. And so, much like many horror movies that start with an idyllic start in order to sort of deliver a terrifying reveal, that was what it was going for on the creative side. But the problem is that in a movie, the horrifying reveal happened 20 minutes in, and in Lorwyn's case, you had to wait 6 months to get the reveal of Shadowmoor. And that was too long. It was too cutesy and too pacifistic to be what Magic was for 3 months or 6 months. And so that creative was a little bit problematic. It was nice that like Shadowmoor could finally like deliver the ghastly horror. But I thought that in terms of delivering a cool Storybook world, that the Throne of Eldraine did a better job at like delivering Storybook tropes and also got to do actual human Grimm's fairy tale Storybook tropes, whereas Lorwyn had no humans and you can't do human fairy tales like Godelocks with no humans.
Okay, so on Shadowmoor, Shadowmoor played around with hybrid. Do you have any stories of messing with hybrid?
I thought it was fun that it enabled monocolor decks in some ways. You could sort of say, I've got all these RG, like gruel hybrid mana cards and some Rakdos hybrid mana cards. I can play them both in mono red, or I can play them in their own respective color pairs. I thought that Chroma is a good example of something that was not well liked when it was presented because the flavor was nothing. And having it come back as devotion in Theros was a lot more popular because the flavor delivered why both the mana symbols and the card were helping you. Like the notion of why it would help you to have a bunch of cards in the board that have red, green hybrid costs in their upper right corner of the card, like why would that help you? The Chroma answer was, I don't know, because the wizard did it. And in Theros, the idea that Thassa is pleased that she has many worshippers that love blue, and the more blue mana symbols they have in their corner, the more devoted they are to blue. Obviously, they want to come to the battlefield, they don't have double blue around, so they must love blue. And so she'll be really impressed when you have a bunch of, you know, Lord of Atlantis or equivalent double blue cards around. That really delivered the flavor much better, and so the mechanic that was basically shunned in Eventide became popular in Theros.
So there's another reason, by the way. I mean, you're correct. I think the flavor was a big thing. The other problem is Chroma didn't have a consistent place it looked. Like, this Chroma card cared about pips in the graveyard. This cared about pips on board. Like, so there wasn't a consistent devotion said, hey, I'm just caring about this one thing, and it allowed you to make a deck about it because all the cards cared about the same thing. And that... So anyway, there's a mechanical, I think, mistake made with Chroma as well as the flavor, I agree, was kind of unfocused as well. So, but anyway, it's a great example of how we try something and it didn't work. And we sort of said, okay, why didn't this work? And figured out how to make it work. You can't always do that, but Chroma was a good example. Okay, so next after Lorwyn and Shadowmoor was Shards of Alara. So what's your memory of Shards of Alara?
Yeah, I was the lead final designer or lead final developer of Shards of Alara, and it's another set that's dear to my heart. It sort of took the guild structure from Ravnica and extended to three colors. And one thing that I sort of tried to get Brady on board with from a creative standpoint was that with three colors, we have an opportunity to not say that each three-color shard is defined by the three colors that it is, but it could be defined by the two colors that it isn't. And so if Bant is the white, blue, green triad, then what would it mean to have a world where there was no chaos and there was no death? And so in Bant's case, what that led to was they don't fight to kill each other. They fight for honor and in tournaments and to have these sort of like honorable duels. And so that ended up feeding into Exalted that Tinsman sort of pitched and his sort of mini team delivered, in that you're each going to have a tournament or duel. That means you each pick your best fighter, line up behind him, cheer him on, and then send him out to the battlefield to hill joust the other guy. It's not going to be a sort of raucous melee of a bunch of guys hacking each other with axes. It's going to be two noble warriors with a bunch of sigils on them, and they're going to fight each other. And so that's a cool example of like how to do some creative and have the creative eventually affect the world building.
Okay, so question for you. Were you on any of the mini teams?
I'm trying to remember. It has been many years.
Well, I'll say this. I know the three mini teams I was on. I don't think you and I are on the same mini team. So yeah. I ran Esper. I was on Naya. I was on Bant.
It's possible that I was like a big customer for the mini teams. And so I was not on them so that I could like critique their work more aggressively. You know what I mean?
Well, that might have been true. Okay.
I do remember that the black, red, green triad, a.k.a. Jund, came back and wanted to do Prey, or Devour, I guess it's called. And I and some other developers said, no, it's not going to work well to have a bunch of cards in the same shard that all want to sacrifice a bunch of creatures. Like Devour, something like, it says something like Devour 2, when this comes into play, when this creature comes into play, you may sacrifice any number of creatures. For each creature you sacrifice this way, put two +1/+1 counters on the creature you just cast, right? So you're going to play a dragon, it's going to eat a bunch of its other little goblin tokens, and he's going to become a huge dragon. And sometimes they also said, after you do all that sacrificing, do damage equal this creature's power to some target. And so they'll give you some further benefit for sacrificing guys, or some of them based on the power that makes it worth a lot of sacrificing guys. But it was true then, and it's true now, that it's not good to like have your deck have 12 guys and then say, sacrifice three creatures, you put this into play, because where are all these creatures going to sacrifice? And we did do things in the shard to give you... make two goblin tokens and have some guys make sacrifices when they die and make a bunch of O1s you can sacrifice and ways to get them food to eat. And that was a big part of the sort of like food chain identity of Jund. But we just knew that a million things like that wouldn't be good. And so we were trying to say, well, the keyword should be death triggers. And whenever a guy dies, you get a benefit. And that way it works in combat, it works in the blow up your dudes, it works when you sacrifice some things. You can still have three or four big creatures that sacrifice a bunch of creatures that come into play and get benefits, and they can trigger all the death triggers, so that'll all work out. But Bill Rose and others were emphatic that it's just cooler to eat a bunch of goblins, make a giant dragon, than to like get little incy weensy triggers on guys dying. And so we should headline giant creature devours others to get big, and have the quiet part be a bunch of creatures that care about death triggers that support staff, but they are not keyworded or ability worded. And I think that was wise, and that devour is a more splashy mechanic, even if it's not something that like spikes are big fans of.
Yeah, so the team I led, like I said, I was on three of the mini teams, was the Esper team. And so the big thing we did is just made all of our creatures artifact creatures.
Right. And we made colored artifacts also.
They were colored artifact creatures.
Now a big thing in the game, right? It's become evergreen, whereas that was once a weird one-off set theme.
Yeah, that was the first time we had done colored artifacts, I think.
Maybe Future Sight had one, I think, to sort of say.
Oh, right. Future Sight had done the throw forward for it. But
Right.
In fact, the funny thing is the Future Sight card was meant to be a throw forward for New Phyrexia, not for here. But we needed it, so I put it. I did it here. I remember that was when we first pitched that. It was just people thought it was fun but quirky, and so.
But it turns out to have a nice mechanical play value to like have artifacts that belong in some decks, and it makes them less likely to be broken, et cetera. So I think it is good to have. Witch's Cauldron kind of stuff that is color identified.
Okay, so I'm not too far from my work. So the last thing I know you worked on was the Zendikar block. Worked on Zendikar. So it was like working on Zendikar.
Yeah, I can remember. Mark relentlessly pitching his vision for the set, trying to get everyone on board, because he kept saying, it's all about lands, right? He wanted to do land block for years. No one ever let him do it. This is another example of everyone else being a stick in the mud, or Mark passionately pursues an excellent idea and triumphs. But one day he started saying Landapalooza instead of saying lands matter, and that made it like more exciting and silly somehow, and people got a little more interested. And then he started saying the sets about maps, chaps, and traps. And maps were a thing you must follow that eventually gets you to a treasure if you do it right, and eventually became the quest mechanic in Zendikar. Those enchantments that are, search for such and such, put a bunch of counters on them, and then once you get some counters, because the actions you took, it explodes and does something awesome, right? Like it says something like whenever you attack the creature, put a quest token on this quest, and when he gets seven quest tokens on it, it flips into something awesome, explodes into something awesome. So those are the maps. And then the chaps were the allies, which are sort of a modified sliver mechanic of a bunch of dudes in five colors that work together to make awesome collective effects. And then the traps were things like Mindbreak Trap that say, when your opponent does the wrong thing, you can play this for reduced cost and suddenly screw them. And so all those things did go the distance, and in modified form did make it to the set. So maps, chaps, and traps became reality, as well as Landapalooza.
Well, what happened was, once we started with lands, and then we added the adventure world. And so it was all the land mechanics plus the adventure world mechanics.
Right.
So, yeah, the maps, chaps, and traps were the adventure world part.
And, like, honestly, like, if you'd said, like, quests, allies, and traps, I think it would have, like, gotten less traction. But, like, literally making things rhyme got in people's head, made it fun, made it silly. And it's like Mark's communication background strikes again, and that you found a way to sort of pitch the idea to make it more catchy, and that did pay off.
Yeah, one of the things I don't think people realize is how much of the internal selling is important. There's a lot of pitching.
A lot of the job is a designer, and as a video designer too, that's a lot of the job is like convincing other people that this will work.
Okay, so I'm not too far from work. So any final memories of working on Magic? Any last thoughts?
It was a dream come true. When I was a kid, I had there's a board game Dragon magazine called File 13. It's all about making board games. And the joke of the game was that as you try to push these board games through the different departments, like, concept and design and art direction and editing, there's a million chances that the games will get diverted to File 13, which is the garbage. And so your games will get canceled all the time. And, like, hardly anything ever comes out. And that's the joke of File 13. And that game has a stage of the game's evolution called playtesting. And it says something like, playtesters are paid but get the name in the back of the credits, but you can't eat the back of the credits, and so they usually end up starving to death in a cardboard box. And that had stuck in my head as like, if you work on games, you will starve to death in a cardboard box. And I was sure that you could not feed yourself, or definitely not feed a family or send your kids to college if you worked on games. And so when I went out to Wizards at first, I thought, this can't be a career, but it'll be like a fun sort of like after grad school job to take. And when I got there, I saw that people had kids there. They were raising them. They were functioning adults in normal societies, so not a bunch of people in cardboard boxes. And this is like a thing that is plausible to sort of have a career in. And so that helped me realize that I could do that too. And eventually sort of like become a full-time game designer in tabletop and video games. And so it was weird that it had never crossed my mind to like pursue game design a career until the whole Crawford thing came up. And so it's wild how many coincidences there are in life, how many opportunities there are, all the privileges and luck I've had is just astounding. But I'm very grateful I got to spend some time there.
So anyway,
5 years there.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like I said, one of the fun things of doing these interviews is getting to talk with people that I worked with for a long time that I don't get to work with currently. So
right.
So I miss you, Devin. I did enjoy working with you.
Yeah, it was fun. Good times. We did make a lot of good sets.
Okay, so I'm at my desk. So we all know what that means. It means it's the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking about magic, it's time for me to be making magic. So Devin, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And everyone, I will see you next time. Bye-bye.